It's unfortunate that the Democrats are fighting between themselves and talking about reducing a very ambitious and visionary plan. And I'm not sure where they're going to end up, but hopefully they don't strip away the climate provisions and allow us to have enough to push forward on programs that are going to be meaningful and actually central to saving the planet.
Welcome to Let's Talk Change. Human history is a long series of adaptations to disruptive change. The impact of innovation and scalability of today's technologies is powerful. They either deteriorate or improve living conditions on Earth. In this podcast series, we sit down with decision makers, innovators, experts, and visionaries to discuss how technologies, business innovations, policies, and improved communication can drive the change we need to amplify sustainable behavior in business and politics for the benefit of the people and the planet.
My name is David Wortmann. It's time again to do an update on the state of climate policies and the energy transition in the USA. It has been 10 months since Joe Biden's inauguration as President of the United States. What has happened since then? Has he started to execute on his ambitious climate policies and energy transition programs? What is the current status and what are the main roadblocks? I have talked to Angelina Galiteva. Angelina is head of the board of the California Independent System Operator, CAISO. She's one of the most powerful and influential energy executives in the United States. Last time I talked to her in this podcast series was in March, right after the power outages in Texas. Therefore, I have asked her if in terms of energy security, everything is back on track again, or if there are more challenges down the road, considering the very dry summer in parts of the United States and the upcoming winter season. At last, we also talk briefly about how the United States is preparing for the International Climate Summit in Glasgow. So please enjoy this episode of Let's Talk Change with Angelina Galiteva. Good morning, Angelina.
Good evening to you from California.
Yes, my kids are still in bed. Your kids should be soon in bed. We have a 9-hour difference. Thank you very much for making the time this morning.
My pleasure.
So last time we talked, Angelina, was in March. It really has been that long. And back then we discussed that we should talk again in the summer. But we were very busy here in Germany as well. We had a general election. You had a quite, let's say, quiet summer, I would say, at least from what I observed from Europe over here. You didn't have any power outage like you had in Texas earlier this year. What are the updates? Is there anything major happening? What has happened since March this year?
Well, I wish I could tell you that we had a very quiet summer, which we didn't. We probably had one of the hottest summers on record in California. We had a lot of fires in the West, which was a problem in terms of operating the grid because of the large transfers had to be either reduced or completely shut down because the fires were too close to the transmission lines. So that, of course, causes operational issues. We didn't have rolling blackouts like we had the summer before, but we came really close in early June. Which made us very nervous for the rest of the summer, but we were able to hold it together and it was okay despite the fact that it was so hot. We had so many fires and it's been extremely dry. All of the reservoirs are really at historic lows and it looks like we're going to have another dry winter. So next summer is going to be pretty challenging as well. I mean, climate change is upon us. We feel it, we know it, and the fact that we made fossil choices is going to be a situation that we're all going to be paying the price for. Point in case, the beautiful Huntington Beach where we live had an oil leak, which caused a very major problem. All the beaches are shut down. My daughter who surfs cannot go surfing. It was an ecological disaster, and it's because one of the pipes burst from the oil rigs outside of the coast and caused a massive spill that actually shut the air show and has shut our beaches.
Well, if California has to shut down beaches, this really...
Tragedy!
But it looks like that the energy system is really under stress as well because of the dry summer, of the upcoming dry winter. But there's even more reason now to put some speed into the increase of renewable energy. I have a few things on my notes here, but maybe you let us know what are the major points the Joe Biden administration has been able to tackle the last couple of weeks and months in terms of policy initiatives.
Well, in terms of policy initiatives, the very optimistic position of the Biden administration not to ignore climate change, but to go back to dealing with climate and acknowledging that we have a problem as a global society and we need to decarbonize. And he has a goal of deep decarbonization by 2035, which is extremely ambitious, but it's good to have ambitious goals. Whether we'll be able to achieve it is a different story, but if people embrace it, at least we'll be moving forward. I know that in California and throughout the West, we're making progress. Most of the states now have deep decarbonization policies and initiatives based on 100% renewable energy scenarios and are pushing forward on those. So that's very, very positive. On the very, very good news, we did achieve 94.5% of renewable energy operation on the grid this spring, and that was without any nuclear. The last remaining nuclear power station was down for maintenance, so it was just pure solar, wind, hydro combination, and some geothermal. So that was fantastic. So the grid can handle it.
But this was in California, right?
This was in California, but others have gotten to those results too with wind. They've done it in Mid-America, so that has happened as well. I think, though, we've discovered something which many of our countries, including Germany, which are pushing to very deep decarbonization. The challenge is going to be reaching those high percentages of 95 and 100% 24/7. And I don't think we've figured out how to deal with the kind of shoulder hours, which is the beginning of the day, and especially in the evening when the sun goes down. That is where we see an increased use in fossil energy, and we have to massively decarbonize.
Maybe let's talk about the state level a little later as well. What I wanted to come to is the bipartisan infrastructure framework
yes.
agreement. This has been one of the major policy initiatives by Joe Biden in terms of energy, in terms of climate. Maybe you can tell us a little bit, what does it really say and why isn't it passed yet?
Well, again, in my opinion, this is a very ambitious infrastructure plan, the so-called Build Back Better plan, which focuses on climate, which focuses on resilience, which focuses on building carbon-free technologies, including transportation and charging infrastructure. So it is a massive bill that will tackle our aging infrastructure and replace it with more resilient carbon-free infrastructure. And it is something that is supported by the Progressive Caucus. But some of the more centrist and moderate Democrats, like Manchin and Sinema, don't seem to be as supportive and are holding it back and negotiating on, one, reducing the amount. It's a $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. And some of it is human infrastructure, such as internet and daycare and better health care. And they're saying they want to reduce it, but it's not clear what they want to reduce. They want to reduce some of the climate initiatives because their states rely on some coal mines. It seems very short-sighted to me. And they want to reduce some of the childcare benefits and healthcare benefits because they see it as an entitlement, which again is very, very strange because the previous administration passed massive amounts of tax cuts for wealthy and corporations, and most of the people didn't see any of the benefits. So it's unfortunate that the Democrats are fighting between themselves and talking about reducing a very ambitious and visionary plan. And I'm not sure where they're going to end up, but hopefully they don't strip away the climate provisions and allow us to have enough to push forward on programs that are going to be meaningful and actually central to saving the planet.
Just to get it straight for us, because over here, we obviously are not that much informed in depth about the policies and how your political system is working. But to get it straight for our audience, you are trying to pass currently a bigger infrastructure package, which mainly has
Bill,
two
yes.
main points. One of them is really infrastructure around transportation information about the railroad bridges. It really tries to improve also public transportation infrastructure. There are a lot of investments going into the area of, let's say, charging infrastructure for electric vehicles as well. So these kind of things, the American power grid as well, should be upgraded for, I think, $73 billion. So a lot of money is going into the infrastructure, which has some positive impact on the energy transition, but also on climate activities. The other part is more around human infrastructures, social expenditure, and these kind of things. So we have these two parts, the hardware infrastructure and then the social infrastructure parts. From my understanding, the hardware infrastructure, so everything which has a positive impact on the energy transition and some climate topics, etc., there has been an agreement already, right? But the other one, on the, around the social parts, there has not been an agreement yet because the Republicans are still blocking it.
Well, also on the climate part, and it's not only the Republicans, it's also the Democrats. Now, if they had all the Democratic voices, including Manchin and Sinema, who are Democrats, they'll be able to push it through. The problem is that two Democrats are holding back along with the Republicans, and yes, they haven't got a single Republican to come on board.
And you already mentioned twice, I think, Senator Joe Manchin, and he even made it to the headlines over here in Germany as well. So he's a Democrat senator, right? And if the Democrats would have his support, they could have already passed all the provisions around clean electricity. But as a Democrat, he's blocking it. Why is he doing that?
Because he's from Virginia, and Virginia is a coal state, and he wants to pander to some of the coal interests. So he's claiming that the climate provisions are more strict and stringent, and he's not supportive of it because he claims it will hurt his constituents. Again, very short-sighted.
So here we talk about a 150 billion clean electricity performance program, which is essentially trying to halve US greenhouse gas emissions from 2005 to 2030.
And limit it, yes. And replace it with cleaner technologies and focus on renewables and decarbonization, yes.
So what are the next steps? So he's blocking it?
Yes. And Bernie Sanders, actually the senator who is the leader for climate change and also, as you know, was one of the nominees for president before and even this time, and he wanted to run for president, and he's very, very green and progressive, took an advertisement out in Virginia against Joe Manchin in the papers and said, Joe Manchin is holding up progress. So now Manchin is at the table, they're talking, they're negotiating, and hopefully in a week or two, I think they have a self-imposed deadline of October 31st, that they will come up with some form of a compromise as to what the programs would be. So it's kind of the centrist against the progressive. The progressive had said, this is our plan, this is what we want, and this is what the president wants, right? An ambitious climate plan, an ambitious social agenda. This is a Roosevelt moment. And the centrists are saying, well, we don't like it, but they won't propose what they want, right? They're not saying what they want. They're not saying what the amount is. They're not saying which programs they want to cut. So how do you negotiate with that? It is like very difficult. So hopefully now people are going to get into the room and start saying what programs are going to be a priority. If they have to reduce the budget, how are they going to reduce it so that they can still achieve the objectives with less resources? So we're waiting to see what the outcome will be and what the negotiations will yield. But today they had meetings at the White House and they're all talking. So I'm hopeful that by October 31st, we'll have some kind of a proposal that everybody can be behind and support.
Right. So listening to all of this, it looks like that going through the legislative procedure, passing bills in the Senate, passing bills in the House of Representatives, coming up with these big legislative packages, which really have tons of billions of dollars included to do all of that. This really sounds, yeah, like a very complicated process still to get the majority in the House, in the Senate as well. Is Biden still on the right track saying that, you know, that he needs to have these legislative procedures, or would have been much easier for him just to go through executive orders?
Much easier to go through an executive order, but also that is not something that lasts very long because an executive order from the next administration changes it immediately. It's much more difficult to change legislation, like Obamacare, for instance, right? The healthcare bill. Nobody's been able to change it. It was very difficult to pass. There were a lot of compromises. It happened. The Republicans tried many times, but they were not successful. So legislation is more permanent. And I believe that the strategy to put it in legislation and make it permanent is the right one. I also think that they need to really push to get to a plan that is meaningful, can have an impact, and get it done. Because in 2022, they may lose the House and the Senate, and they won't have the trifecta that they have now, which is Democratic control, not very large, small, but still Democratic control of the House, Senate, and the White House.
Okay, so Biden is really a lot under pressure. He's still going through the right strategy, you're saying, not using the executive orders. We talked about it in our last discussion in March as well. So you're still saying that he's doing it right on that front. But apart from this infrastructure package we just talked about and the Clean Electricity Performance Program, which is sort of part of that, the U.S. administration also has published just a few days ago a roadmap to build a climate-resilient economy. So this is more or less like a wish list, right?
Exactly. It is more like a wish list, like this is where we would like to go and this is why we need to do it to garner more support for the larger package, which is the infrastructure package, because it's infrastructure that will get us to the wish list and what their priorities for funding are going to be. And we need to be focusing on mitigation and long-term adaptation as well.
So we have elections at least of part of the Senate and part of the House next year in 2022. And now still Biden has published this roadmap, which is very ambitious and tries to repeat some of the objectives, or a lot of the objectives he has been running on, right? On 100% clean electricity until 2035, but also phasing out the combustion engine, etc. So this is out there, right? Is this something where the Republicans will actually do their election platform against it? Or do you see some more unity now and that this ambitious program still has a chance to pass the House and the Senate next year, even if the majorities are changing?
I am not sure if the majorities change, if they will pass. The Republicans, as you know, most of them deny that climate change is caused by humans. They think it's just natural and it swings back and forth and this is not anything to be seriously concerned about. But many of them will be quiet. They won't openly protest against it because they also see that public sentiment and public opinion is changing in favor of renewables, is changing in favor of cleaner vehicles, is changing in favor of customers having their own solar on their house, their own storage, and charging an electric vehicle. And they also see the fact that customers and their constituents like to be energy independent. And they see energy independence in renewables a lot more than they see it in gasoline and combustion engines. And also the younger population, especially everywhere in the world, is keenly aware that emissions from power plants and from cars are the largest contributors to climate change. The younger population is embracing cleaner vehicles, electric vehicles, and being able to generate their own energy. And also those companies, the renewable energy companies, are becoming powerful players. They're making lots of money. And they have now established operations in most of the states where Republicans are as well. So they're being very careful about being anti-climate and anti-business. They may be anti-climate, but they're pro-business. They're going to support the renewable energy businesses that are developing and growing in their states and not openly oppose them, but they're also going to pay lip service to, we need natural gas and we need coal because the coal miners and the jobs. So I think the counterpoint that the Biden administration has put forward in saying that Build Back Better needs to be done with good jobs, good green jobs, and good union jobs is a very powerful message as well. But he needs to deliver. He really needs to deliver because when they start pushing these programs forward, they also need to have labor standards, they need to have operational standards, and they need to ensure that everything is built up to code. So a lot of the codes and standards have to change as well to adapt to the new reality. And I don't see that happening yet.
Well, before we talk a little bit about the state level, a few other things.
No, even on the federal level, this is not happening, yeah. Especially on the federal level. I mean, if you're going to have an ambitious program of electric vehicle infrastructure nationwide, you need to have standards that actually cover all of the infrastructure, high-speed charging. All of them are very, very different, and all of them touch the infrastructure for energy delivery and distribution. So you've got to make sure that you do it in a way that's safe and doesn't cause a ripple effect throughout the grid.
Well, and I think that's something which needs to be shared as well, right?
Yes, that, it's a blind spot.
Yes, and that in the U.S., the responsibility of a lot of the policies, infrastructure, etc., which are relevant for the energy transition, are actually part of the responsibility of the state level.
Some of it, yes, but if you're going to have an electric vehicle charger manufacturer have to, you know, comply with different standards in every state and sometimes different standards in every county, it becomes very, very difficult. We had that with the solar program. You would have thought we learned the lesson to standardize from the beginning, but we're still making the same mistakes. They're learning. There's no universal standards for installation of, you know, the 60 kW charging stations and the larger ones. It's something that I think is a work in progress.
So a lot of that is policy development now, which we have talked about, but a lot of that is also executions. Did Biden already fill up all the main and key positions for energy transition, transport transition, climate policies?
Some of them are filled, some of them are still being filled, but from what I'm hearing from people on the ground, even if the top position is filled, the support staff is not there. So it's taking a long time for the wheels to turn. There needs to be a lot of collaboration between the Department of Energy, the Department of Transportation, the Environmental Protection Agency, and it's very, very bureaucratic and very slow, especially since the previous administration focused on destroying a lot of the departments that were focused on climate, that were focused on clean energy, and they completely gutted the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. So it's been slower, and maybe because of COVID as well, the circumstances have been difficult. People are working from home. It's hard to get folks to move. Many of them are working remotely and still haven't moved to Washington. And some of them left the jobs before they even moved to Washington, just because the frustration level is so high. So it's not an easy process. It's going to take time. And I fear that we're up against 2022, and 2022 is going to be an election year. They need to start registering some big wins very quickly so that they can have momentum going into 2022. Right now, Biden is slipping in the polls, some of it because of COVID, and that was unforeseeable. We thought it would be over, but then the Delta variant brought us back into shutdowns over the summer, and it has extended completely reopening. So now with the vaccines and people getting more vaccines, maybe we'll be able to reopen, have a calmer winter, and go back into spring in full force and have the platform unwrap, moving forward and upwards, as opposed to being stalled and nothing happening. And okay. Supply chain issues. I mean, I don't know if you have them in Europe, but we have massive supply chain issues here. The ports of LA and the ports of Long Beach are backlogged for weeks. So now they have a special order where they're going to start operating 24/7, 7 days a week, and hopefully they can catch up with the backlog. But we see the supply chain issues in the stores. We see it all around, and we see it in the prices, which is not good for the administration.
Right. So it looks like it has not been a matter of finding the right people to do the job in the administration, but actually getting them on speed in terms of trying to get the infrastructure in place, to get the procedures back in place, which have been destroyed by the Trump administration in the past. And the time window is actually closing because 2022 is up there and the elections are coming up and he needs to have some quick wins. What about the vice president? We don't hear a lot of the vice president here. What role does she have here?
I know. We haven't heard from her very much. We haven't seen from her very much. She's not very active. I mean, I remember back at the Clinton and Al Gore days, Al Gore was extremely active in pushing a very strong climate agenda and very strong environmental programs. He was a very active vice president and had a platform and had issues that he was in charge of. I'm still curious to see what Kamala Harris is going to be focusing on and what she'll be doing. She seems to pop up and then disappear and nothing major is happening, which I'm hopeful will change, because we want a woman and the first vice president woman of color to have a broader role, but be a very effective one in pushing forward, whether it's women's rights, whether it's energy and environment. I certainly hope she will embrace that. She is from California. She understands those issues. Whether it's clean transportation, whether it's education and academics. But my goodness, pick up some issue and start moving it forward and be more visible and active and effective.
What is the reason? Why is she that inactive?
I don't know. I would never have thought that she would be as inactive as she is. I don't think anybody is stopping her. Maybe she's unsure of herself. Maybe she also doesn't have all of the people that she wants having moved to Washington and being able to participate fully because of COVID. I don't know, but I'm hoping it changes, and it changes really fast. You know, I had great hopes for her. She's from California. She's supposed to be very progressive on all the issues we care about.
Yeah. So talking about California, last time in March, you told me that you had a big rollout of storage because obviously you need storage, like everyone else needs storage, you know, with the high penetration of renewable energy. Has this market rollout worked? You mentioned something around 1.2 gigawatt, which was supposed to be installed until the summer. Did this actually happen?
Not quite. We had supply chain issues. Several ships from China caught fire and the batteries burned, apparently. And also they had some labor shortages. So not everything was installed, but about 900 megawatts was installed, and it made a huge difference this summer. And more is coming online. But I think also one of the other benefits that happened as a result of storage is that now we have more experience with storage and the capabilities and the benefits that it can bring. And so dispatching it at the right time and charging the batteries in such a way so you can optimize operations is key. What we were relying on in the summers before was a lot of the storage that's behind the meter that has actually been installed to benefit the customer. So if the storage is providing demand side reduction on the customer side, at the end of the day, when you need it to support the grid and you're trying to pull energy from those batteries, the batteries are depleted and there's no energy left. So we're like, well, where are the batteries? They're not showing up. If the batteries are installed in larger battery banks and you have a designated portion of them to support the grid on call, they operate much better and you get much better results. So we're learning as we go along. I mean, this getting to the 100% renewable energy 24/7, 365 days a year is a learning process in terms of how to even operate technologies in an effective way. And what types of technologies, and what's becoming more and more clear now, is the need for long-term storage. Batteries are excellent for those ramps up and down, maybe 2 or 3 hour intervals as well. But when you go into longer intervals of load shifting, or you go into multi-days of where there's no solar radiation and there's not enough energy to charge the batteries, then how do you deal with those situations? So planning longer term on how to get to the 100% renewables and be able to ride through the night, be able to ride through the ramps, which are extremely steep and very aggressive at the end of the day. We're at 20,000 megawatts for 4 hours every day. At the end of the day, batteries are coming in to help with that, but it's mostly met by gas at this stage of the game. So we have to decarbonize fuels as well, or come up with long-term storage that is effective.
Angelina, you are head of the chair of one of the largest grid operator in the United States, of the California Independent System Operator. You mentioned in the beginning of our discussion that you had a very dry summer. You're expecting a very dry winter as well. How are you preparing from an operational point of view that there will not be any power outages in the next couple of weeks and months in California?
With careful planning, and I wish I could say that we have 100% guarantees, but you never have 100% guarantees in the energy sector. So in the summers, we hope that we don't have fires, because if you have fires that take out your power lines that go north and south, then we cannot pull hydro from the Pacific Northwest, whether it's Oregon, Washington, or even all the way up to Canada. So those fires, which we had this summer in Oregon, had never been seen before. Having to turn down the Pacific Intertie, which is 5,000 megawatts, and not have access to that hydro was very critical for us. So we're trying to make those interties more resilient. We're trying to develop offshore wind, which is a very exciting proposition for us, and we're going to be collaborating with the Pacific Northwest states on that as well. What we're hopeful for is that the Pacific Northwest seems to be getting more rainfall. So having access to their hydro is like Europe having access to Norway, right? Even though Norway had issues this summer as well. We're all going to have to deal with a planet that maybe is not going to have as much hydropower as we originally thought possible. Again, a greater need for coming up with a solution for decarbonizing fuels, whether that's hydrogen, whether it's synthetic natural gas, which is hydrogen synthesized with carbon from the air or carbon-intensive industries, whether it's some other new technology for storage that we don't know yet about, capturing certainly the offshore wind and using that to complement solar, which seems to be working quite nicely in terms of the load profiles for California, and then using the wind energy to generate hydrogen or charge the batteries. But we've got to find more solutions and more diversity in our resources, because just relying on solar and hydro and onshore wind is not enough for us. We need more. We need more geothermal. We need more biomass. We need more pumped hydro and long-term storage.
So last question. We have the International Climate Conference. The COPs are coming up in Glasgow in a couple of weeks. Is there any preparation yet by the Californian government or by the Biden administration for this important conference?
I'm sure they will be participating, and I'm sure that they'll have dedicated staff. I know that California has a delegation going from our Senate and our Assembly, and they're very focused on talking about what California is doing and learning what other states are doing as well. Collaboration is critical. And one thing I didn't mention on your previous question, what are we doing in terms of making sure we have enough energy in the West, is collaborating with an integrated market. As you know, there is no transmission operator, regional transmission operator in the Western United States. So from Colorado all the way to California, east, west, north, south, there is no regional operator. So we have the energy imbalance market that the California ISO launched in 2014 and now covers over 84% of the greater West, which has led to collaboration and optimization of our grid systems and a lot more states in the West embracing the carbon-free solution because it is the most cost-effective solution and it works. So more integrated markets and figuring out how we optimize operations across the board is also going to help because it allows us to share resources across the West and help each other out so there's no rolling blackouts. But that also means transmission. It also means grids. It also means that infrastructure plan has to be passed so that we can all rely on it and we can build the resources that we need. So I'm hopeful that in Glasgow, those conversations will take place because you've got the integrated European market. We're also solving this issue and this problem and looking at it in a context of the states and countries that are leading to deep decarbonization, taking the lessons learned and having the knowledge exchange, I think is going to be beneficial for all of us as we transition forward, not to be making the same mistakes and to have more comfort and courage in the fact that others have done it and have seen it and we're implementing the solutions before we have the problems.
Angelina, thank you very much for this very good deep dive and update, not just on the US Biden administration, on what is happening in the energy and climate policy area, but also on some issues and topics you talked about at the California state level here. Thank you very much. And I think we should probably check in after this package has been passed or after some major other events have happened. So we will stay tuned. We have a close contact over the next couple of weeks and months, and we just pick up the phone again once
Definitely.
We think there's time for another update from the United States.
Yes, and as we look towards Glasgow, let's see if the subnational states get together again, because at the last COP, a lot of the national states were not pushing as hard on climate, so we had the under 2 MOU, which was the subnationals leading the charge. Hopefully the subnationals are just as committed as they were before and ready to show what are the pathways forward? Because a lot of the progress is being made on a state level, on a city level, on a regional level. And those are things we shouldn't ignore.
That's right. This is a really important point to look at, because not just the federal and the central governments are key, but lower levels of policies as well. But of course, as well, the economy, the industry, there are a lot more actors who are joining the game to combat climate change. Thank you very much again. And I wish you a great remaining evening. And I will start the day over here.
And have a wonderful day. Okay.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you'll join us next time on Let's Talk Change. We are proud to be powered by DWR Eco, an international cleantech consultancy for business strategies, communications, and public affairs.